You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. If you're listening for the first time, this is a sample episode as part of the Kick-Ass Politics preview station. If you like what you hear, there are many more episodes to enjoy on our main podcast at Kick-Ass Politics with Ben Mathis. You can subscribe for free by going to Kick-Ass Politics with Ben Mathis on iTunes or click on the link in the information page for this episode. Also, feel free to check out our website for show notes, book recommendations, and more at kickasspolitics.com. And now, I hope you enjoy this preview episode of Kick-Ass Politics. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible has over 180,000 audiobooks available to download for your smartphone, tablet, or MP3 player. And right now, Kick-Ass Politics listeners can get a free audiobook as part of Audible's 30-day trial. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com and go get your free audiobook. Hi there, I'm Ben Mathis and welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. In the last podcast, I spoke with Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute about the nuclear deal with Iran that President Obama announced last week. We covered a lot of the broad strokes of the agreement, as well as the ramifications for the Middle East and for U.S. diplomacy. But in this podcast, I want to focus on the one who has the most to lose in this deal. And that, of course, is Israel. So today, I'm going to talk to Danny Aiello. He served as the Israeli ambassador to the United States from 2002 to 2006, and then from 2009 to 2013, he was Deputy Foreign Minister for Israel under the current Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. He's been a political advisor to three different prime ministers, and today he's a frequent columnist for the Wall Street Journal and the Jerusalem Post. In today's podcast, he'll discuss what the Iran deal means for Israel, how it may lead to some surprising alliances with Israel's Arab neighbors, and we'll talk about what Danny's old boss, Prime Minister Netanyahu's next move could be. All that and more with Danny Aiello in just a moment.
From Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
I'm here talking today with Danny Aiello. He served as Israeli ambassador to the U.S. and deputy foreign minister under Benjamin Netanyahu. Danny, thanks for coming on the show to talk about what this Iran deal means for Israel.
Good to be with you.
Well, John Kerry said this week, and I quote, "The nuclear deal with Iran makes Israel safer." Danny, do you feel safer?
Unfortunately not, and it's not just me. It's the entire people of Israel, and it's across political lines. Even the opposition now is teaming up with the government against this agreement. And it's not just Israel. It's also the entire region, the Arab countries, the Saudi Arabia, Egypt, all the allies, the natural allies here of the United States. And the reason is because this agreement not only did not dismantle all the capabilities and the potential, the nuclear potential of Iran, it actually preserved it. And this is the main flaw, I believe, in this agreement.
I guess I'll just ask straight out, how is this deal bad for Israel?
I would say it's bad for Israel on two accounts, and it's also bad for the entire international community, especially the United States, and I'll try to explain. First of all, the deal, as I said, allows Iran to retain its potential at any given time in the future. They can deceive, cheat, as they have been known to do that, and break out to a bomb. Secondly, all the cash infusion, $150 billion that the Iranians will get now, will be able also to, some of it at least, be funneled to continue their terror activities, sponsoring and inspiring and actually directing terror activities throughout the region and beyond. And the third thing is that the signal to the entire world, and especially rogue regimes, is that if you are defiant, if you are aggressive, if you break and violate all the commitments and agreements that you are a signatory of, instead of being penalized, it's being rewarded. So just think that other countries can take a cue from the Iranians and try to do the same.
Well, yeah, it definitely sets a bad precedent. And part of me is just in shock because it was only 4 days before this deal was announced that the president of Iran was taking to the streets and joining Iranians who were shouting, "Death to Israel, death to America." And 4 days later, we just delivered a bundle of goodies to their lap as a reward.
Yes, and we must understand that we're talking here about a very ideological, extremely ideological regime that there is no meeting point between it and Western civilizations. And for them, in terms of their policy, in terms of their mentality, in terms of their conduct, a written word or agreement is not something to be bound by, but actually to further their interests. So they are now out of the hook, and they can continue with their very, very aggressive goal of domination in the region, hegemony, and, of course, not just in the region.
Certainly there are other countries that are very concerned right now in the region, and it's funny to me because this deal is making for some pretty strange bedfellows in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia has come out against the deal, and right now probably seems to be Israel's best friend in the region, I'd say. How do you see that relationship evolving as both nations pursue their mutual interest in containing Iran's larger ambitions? And what other nations do you see as potential allies in the region moving forward?
Well, there's definitely now converging interest between Israel and the entire Arab Sunni world, certainly Saudi Arabia, but also other Gulf countries, Egypt, Jordan as well. And the problem now is that not only these countries feel very vulnerable, but they may also go the route of a nuclear arms race. We have already seen Saudi Arabia and Egypt and even Jordan turning into Russia to get nuclear technology and to buy nuclear reactors, civil nuclear reactors. But this is how the Iranian program started about 20 years ago when the Russians decided or agreed to supply to Iran the Bushehr civil reactor, and we know where we ended. So the entire Middle East, and indeed beyond, the entire international community now, may see an arms race, a nuclear arms race, may see the end of the non-proliferation treaty. And coupled with that, the fact that the Iranians can continue building their intercontinental ballistic missiles, which are used only for a nuclear payload, that makes the world much, much more dangerous.
It's definitely creating a slippery slope for other nations in the Middle East. Now, the Iranians, of course, say that they just want nuclear power for peaceful means. Is that just an outright lie?
Absolutely. We have seen it. We know that they have been cheating all along. And without the intelligence revelation about Natanz and their nuclear and the armed nuclear, of course they wouldn't have been showing the world what they've got. Also, we must remember that Iran is the second largest possessor of natural gas and oil. They do not need nuclear programs for energy. Quite the contrary. It's much more expensive than what they have. So if you couple everything together, it is a very, very, I would say, gloomy picture that we see.
So you find the whole peaceful purposes just for energy to be rather suspect then, huh?
It's a ruse. And I'll tell you then what's also very frustrating is the fact that Iran was no match to the international powers, to the P5 plus one led by the United States. And actually they were begging for these negotiations about 3 years ago because they were on the verge of total collapse because of the sanctions, effective sanctions that began to work. So instead of using all the leverages in their possession, the P5 plus one actually elevated Iran to be a par in the negotiation. And instead of demanding concessions from Iran, which are not just concessions, actually demanding Iran to stop violating international agreements, Security Council resolutions, and their own commitments under the non-proliferation treaty. Instead of doing that, they started a negotiation from Iranians' demands. And the result is very bad. And to say that there was no other way to deal with Iran, I think is wrong. I believe that continuing with the sanctions and the threat of sanctions, not taking off the table a military option, would have brought the Iranians to a much more reasonable deal from the international community perspective.
When the negotiations were going on behind closed doors, AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, which is Israel's biggest lobbyist in Washington, released a list of five requirements for a good deal. The list included, number one, inspectors must be permitted unimpeded access to suspect sites. Number two, Iran must fully explain its prior weaponization efforts. Three, sanctions relief must commence only after Iran complies with its commitments. Number four, Iran's nuclear weapons quest must be blocked for decades. And number five, finally, Iran must dismantle its nuclear infrastructure so it has no path to a nuclear weapon. Does this deal achieve any of those goals?
I'm afraid not. First of all, they have all passes to the nuclear because they still kept the centrifuges. It is true that according to the agreement, only 6,000 of them. I mean, I say only. This is a huge sum. I mean, it sounds quite impressive when you hear that two-thirds of the centrifuges are inoperable. But it's not two-thirds of 10. It's two-thirds of 19,000. So they still have 6,000 and more working. The rest of them are being just stored so they can be used at any time. And Iran is allowed for research and development for and they can develop the upgraded and a new generation of centrifuges for the future. And I think this is very, very dangerous. Also, they can continue with their ballistic missiles programs. And in many ways, I do not believe that they will adhere to this agreement. They will find any loophole to circumvent it, and they're very sophisticated. It will be very, very difficult for the international inspectors to continue and play this cat and mouth game, as especially as they have all the tools to do it. If there was a complete dismantling, it would have been much more easy to do the monitoring.
Right. Well, you know, the whole goal of this negotiation supposedly was going to be to increase Iran's breakout time to develop a nuclear weapon. Do you think that this actually does increase that breakout time, or does it in reality decrease it?
And what would that be? Yes, in the short term, if indeed they will remove all the yellow cake and the enriched uranium that they already have done, you know, with a few tons that they have, yes, it may increase their breakout time. But this is could be very short lived. In the long run, as I say, they could create a situation where a breakthrough or a breakout time could be very short, and as I mentioned, once they can cheat, once they have 24 days at least before they allow inspectors into their military site, and the military site here where is what so important, then they can easily create a situation where the breakout time will be much shorter, and at any time in the future, of their own choosing, they can decide to just walk away from this agreement altogether and have a bomb in a very, very short while.
One of the things that baffles me is we already gave away the store pretty much in this agreement. We're giving them permission to pursue their nuclear ambitions. And on top of that, perhaps this shows what terrible negotiators we have on our side, is on top of that, we threw in some concessions that I can't imagine we even needed to throw in. I mean, we're giving them the ability to pursue a nuclear program. What else do we really owe them? But on top of all this, the U.S. has agreed to unfreeze $100 to $150 billion in assets and money with no restrictions on its use for purchasing arms and funding terrorism, including funding Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Assad regime in Syria, for whom Iran has been pretty much their best friend in the region. On top of that, under this agreement, top IRGC and Quds Force terrorists have been removed from the sanctions list, including Ahmad Vahidi, mastermind of the 1994 Jewish Community Center bombing in Argentina that killed 85 people. Isn't that just a huge slap in the face to Israel?
Well, it is, not just to Israel, but to all those who are fighting and defending themselves against international terrorism. Also, one of the Iranians who is now in the clear is Qassam Soleimani, the head of the Al-Quds, which is the mastermind and a real architect, an arch-terrorist. So certainly, when you look all around, this is a very, very unfortunate deal, which allows Iran to become much stronger, much more influential in the region, and I would say even beyond. And again, I think the sign to the international community and to all the rogue regimes and terror organizations is really the wrong signal.
We'll take a quick break now, and then we'll come back with Ambassador Danny Aiello. And we'll talk about your former boss, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and his relationship with the U.S., and maybe what his next move is going to be from here. Back in just a moment. This portion of the podcast is sponsored by Fiverr. You've heard me rave about Fiverr before. That's Fiverr with two R's. Fiverr is the world's largest online marketplace for services with over 100 categories, all offered for a fixed base price of just $5. They've got logo design, business consulting, marketing, business cards and stationery, web design, translation, proofreading, legal consulting, and just about any other service you can possibly imagine, all offered at a base price of just $5. In fact, you know the announcer who does our intro on Kick-Ass Politics? I found him on Fiverr. a professional radio announcer to do our intro for just $5. And right now, if you go to kickasspolitics.com and click on the Fiverr ad on our sponsor page, you'll be showing your support for the show, and you'll get some great offers on services tailored to your needs. Whatever you need done, find it on Fiverr. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics and want to help keep us on the air, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and even more interesting programs in the future. That's gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. And now, back to the show. And we're back. I'm talking today with Ambassador Danny Ayalon, who was the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. and deputy foreign minister under Benjamin Netanyahu. Danny, certainly those of us who've paid attention to the media have watched as the relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama became more and more strained over the past couple of years here. I'm curious, as a former ambassador to the U.S., and someone who has been in Israeli-U.S. politics for quite a while now, have you ever seen the U.S.-Israeli relationship at a lower point than it is right now between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu?
I have not, and it's quite unfortunate that there is not much trust between the two leaders, and especially at a time when U.S. and Israel consultation and strategic, I would say strategic planning is critical for both countries' interests. And there is enough blame to share around, and I think now it is imperative for the two of them to just sit together, iron out all the differences, and work together and find a pattern of a decent relationship, and especially not surprising anyone, and working together for the remainder of the Obama's term. The next 18 months are going to be very crucial in many, many ways. So I think it's very important for them to sit and start restarting or resetting their relationship.
Well, there are those who say that Benjamin Netanyahu's confrontational approach in dealing with the Obama administration, particularly his speech before Congress, might have done more harm than good in alienating Israel from the White House and from the P5+1 in the nuclear negotiation, essentially putting Israel in a corner as the negotiations carried on. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say certainly things could have been handled differently, but I don't think that this is the real issue, because the real issue is the content. And I think here the different outlook on the region, on the Islamic terrorism, on Iran, on the Palestinian issue, of course, put the two administrations in a collision course. But I would say with more finesse and more diplomatic behavior, many of the obstacles could have been averted, and it's still not too late to do that.
Well, hopefully not. Some people are saying that Prime Minister Netanyahu just has to wait out the next 18 months, and then he'll have a new U.S. president to work with, which, whether it's a Republican or even if it's Hillary Clinton, is probably a better ally than Obama has been for Israel so far. Do you think waiting it out for 18 months is a realistic option, though?
No, not at all, because first of all, 18 months in politics and in the geopolitics of the region, and today actually the entire globe, is almost an eternity. And we see how things can turn almost on a flip of a coin. And not just in the Middle East. We can see it in Southeast Asia, or we can see it in the Crimea, or anywhere else around the globe. So it is imperative for the two leaders to work together, as I don't think there is a better ally and a dependable ally for the United States in the region than Israel, and certainly their relations with the United States is critical for Israel's well-being and security. So I think that this should be the main goal now, first of all, to reestablish the trust, the mutual confidence, the mutual respect, and work together. Whether they like each other ideologically or on a personal basis or not, it's besides the point, because they are not just representing their own selves. They are leaders of two nations, and this is why they should put all personal feelings aside.
So then you would say that the Prime Minister's next move would be to rebuild relations with President Obama, not go to Congress and try and block this? Because that's what some people are saying his next move could be, to do a hard lobby on lawmakers in the U.S. Congress to try and block the deal. But it certainly is a gamble that may or may not pay off. And I think there are many that say that that might be too much of a risk of even further alienating the White House.
I would say that certainly Prime Minister Netanyahu is entitled to make his case. I think that's his duty. But at the same time, it could be much more nuanced, given the fact that the chances for Congress to block the agreement are very slim, if not nil, not non-existent altogether. So I think this is the time for confidence-building measures vis-a-vis the president and the administration. And in that respect, I believe that not pushing too much in Congress, I mean, let the American process consume and exhaust itself without any foreign interference, and at the same time work together already now with the administration on plan B, and that is how to preserve and actually enhance Israel's deterrent capabilities and defensive capabilities against the enemies in the region, and first and foremost Iran, because this is also a great American interest, to keep stability here and security for all of us.
Well, you bring up an interesting point there, because the White House went to great lengths to reassure Gulf states, making some very generous promises before the deal was announced. Should Israel do the same and just make the best of a bad situation? And if so, what do you think Prime Minister Netanyahu would ask for?
Well, I would say that would be the minimum now to enhance Israel's capabilities. I think this is the most important thing to do. And the second thing would be, and that could also be presided by the United States, or it can be without the United States altogether, to realign the region. As we mentioned before, there is now converging interest between Israel and the main Sunni Arab countries, certainly Saudi Arabia. So certainly there could be some more cooperation, maybe not a very salient one for obvious reasons, but certainly there can be a development of a new alliance between Israel and the Sunni Arab countries.
The last thing I want to ask you, worst case scenario here, what would have to happen for Israel to feel justified in launching a preemptive strike against Iran? And are we at that point already?
Well, I don't want to be too specific, except to say that Israel has always known and has the capability and the will, of course, to defend itself. And this will not change. And I believe that I don't want to have any benchmarks for what will happen and what should happen.
Benchmarks don't mean anything anymore, if you ask Obama, I suppose. I mean, just ask Syria, ask Bashar al-Assad. There are no red lines left.
Right, but I would say that certainly a much better coordination, consultation with the U.S., with the U.S. and Israel seeing eye to eye into the next phase of Israel deterrent and defensive capabilities would certainly diminish any potential of any surprise military, let's say, move in the region. And this is also why I think it is so important now for both Mr. Obama, President Obama, and Prime Minister Netanyahu to sit together and work out a path into the future, a roadmap for the next 18 months.
Well, certainly I hope that they can work it out, at least to the point of making the best out of this bad situation. And Danny, don't be fooled. You and Israel have a lot of friends still here in the U.S., and we are certainly hoping for the best for Israel. Danny Aiello, thank you so much for coming on the show and taking the time to give us Israel's perspective on the recent Iran nuke deal. And all the best going forward here.
Thank you very much, Dan, and we really appreciate your support and solidarity, and that goes coast to coast through so many segments of the American society, understanding that actually we are here in the trench line for all of us, and certainly the relationship and the great alliance, which is a natural alliance between Israel and the United States, will continue.
Well, what's good for Israel is good for the U.S., I think, and like I said, you have a lot of friends here, so... don't despair.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much, man.
Thanks, Danny. My thanks again to Danny Aiello for coming on the show to give the Israeli perspective on the nuclear agreement with Iran. Danny frequently writes on issues relating to Israeli politics and Middle East policy, so if you want to read more, then visit his blog at DannyAiello.com. That's DannyAiello.com. I'll also include a link in the show notes for this podcast. I hope you'll subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you can automatically get new episodes as they become available. And while you're there, I'd appreciate it if you left us a review. That helps a lot with the show's rankings on iTunes. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics and you want to help keep us on the air, then support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep the lights on over here and will be greatly appreciated. That's GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@KickAssPolitics.com or leave a voicemail on the toll-free listener hotline at 844-KA-POLITICS. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.